Well, hello everybody, and we've made it to Friday night, haven't we? As we wrap up the week with our final book from Shelley Boyum Breen. And this is Shelley Bean, the Sports Queen. All week we've been so lucky to have Shelley Boyum Breen be so generous to send us these books. And she sent us five of them, and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, that's five. So we did one each night, and we wrap it up tonight with Shelley Bean, the Sports Queen, plays a game of catch. So she's going to be learning to play baseball and softball tonight on Shelley Bean, the Sports Queen, plays a game of catch. So that's going to be fun when we start with that. And then as we did last week on Friday night, we don't go back to the Magic Treehouse with Jack and Annie tonight. We'll resume their voyages and adventures on Monday night when we come back. But tonight, we go back to a little bit of a story for the older folks, the high schoolers, the teenagers, the parents, the grandmas and the grandpas and the uncles and the aunts and the brothers and the sisters. And last week, we started with John Steinbeck's The Red Pony. We're going to pick up with part two of that four-part serial story by Mr. John Steinbeck. Last week, we read The Red Pony and the story of Jody Tiflin, his dad Carl Tiflin, the farmhand Billy Buck, and Mother Tiflin. So tonight, another chapter in the Red Pony story, and this time it's called The Great Mountains. So that will be our second story of the night from John Steinbeck. But let's start with Shelley Bean, the Sports Queen, plays a game of catch. And we take a look at who the cast of characters are here tonight. And Shelley Bean, the Sports Queen, has along, of course, her co-mascot Spike and Buster, her two good dogs. And Olivia, her cousin, shows up tonight. So we get to meet Olivia in this story. And her brothers, Matt and Ben, are with her as well. So let's get started. And the first picture is of a whole group of people, including Shelley Bean and her brothers and their bunch of other fans. They're sitting, it looks like, in the stands cheering on a ball game. It was a hot summer day when Shelley Bean and her brothers Ben and Matt went to watch their cousin Olivia at her softball game. It was so fun to see a lot of neighbors and classmates at the ballpark. And Shelley Bean has a little bucket of popcorn, and she threw a piece of popcorn and says, "Catch Spike," and Spike's her dog. So she was giving her dog a treat. Shelley Bean spotted her friends Maya and Audrey in the stands. They were having a great time cheering, eating popcorn, and singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" with the crowd. Shelley Bean was so excited she held her breath when Olivia was up to bat. She loved watching the runners and the sound of the ball hitting the bat. Crack! And it shows a picture of Olivia. She's got her helmet on and her bat, and she's standing at the plate, and there's a catcher ready to catch the ball. Shelley Bean couldn't believe how easily the players could catch and throw. She wanted to try it too. After the game, some players stayed to play catch. Olivia asked Shelley Bean and her brothers to join them. Shelley Bean hadn't used a mitt before, so Olivia gave her one that fit her hand and asked Shelley Bean to be her partner. Olivia was really good at softball. As Shelley Bean tossed the ball underhand, she felt butterflies in her stomach. It popped up high in the air, but Olivia caught it anyway. And Olivia's giving some hints to Shelley Bean, says, "Make sure your glove is up and ready to catch the ball." And then Olivia tossed the ball back to Shelley Bean underhand. She watched the ball, raised her hands above her face, and felt the ball land with a thud in the pocket of her mitt. Olivia and Shelly Bean practice throwing underhand and catching. Let's go for three times without dropping it. One, two. Shelly Bean was really getting the hang of it. Swoop, pop. Oh, Bud, they'd got it three in a row. They made three straight catches. Shelly Bean started to throw the ball to Olivia again. This time, Spike wanted to join the fun. He jumped up and caught the ball in his mouth, and he started running away. And Shelly Bean started to chase him. Spike, no, come back. And Spike did come back as all the kids laughed as Spike brought the ball back to Shelly Bean, and she patted him on the back saying, "Good boy, Spike. We can practice more later." "Now let's try overhand," said Olivia. Okay, Shelly Bean said nervously. Shelly Bean's first toss didn't go very far, and it bounced through the grass to Olivia's feet. Shelly thought, maybe this isn't so easy after all. And it looks like Spike has chased a chipmunk up the tree. She saw the others out of the corner of her eye playing catch. They were throwing the ball so hard to each other, and it would smack in their mitts. Shelly Bean decided to ask Coach Carroll for some tips. Coach Carroll was happy to help. She said, "Reach your throwing arm back behind your head and twist your body. When you let go of the ball, follow through by reaching toward Olivia." Shelly Bean tried a few more times. Smack! Finally, the ball made it into Olivia's mitt. "Gosh, Spike," she said to her dog, "throwing and catching overhand is a lot harder to learn than underhand. May I please come back again after your game and try throwing overhand a few more times?" asked Shelly Bean. "I think I need more practice." "Of course, little cousin," said Olivia. "I'm so proud of you. Maybe next time you can bat and run the bases. I think Spike might even run with you." I bet Spike would. He loved to run around the bases. Shelly Bean, her brothers, and Spike left the park and walked back home before it got dark. It was time for dinner with the family, and they had a lot of news to share. And her brothers Matt and Ben are sitting there, and guess what? Shelly Bean, Ben, and I played catch today. She has a strong arm. And Ben says, "She sure does, Matt." And it looks like they're having potatoes and a salad and a glass of milk. They're sitting down for supper. It was so fun," said Shelly Bean. "Sometimes I can learn a new sport pretty fast." And Mom says, "Good work, Beanie." Shelly Bean was pretty tired from her busy day, but there was one more thing she was excited to do. She and Spike did their extra big super dive onto her bed, and she pulled out her art supplies and her special crown of sports. Shelly Bean finished drawing her baseball mitt and said, "We did it again, Spike," and she colored it red. She put her colorful crown on her head, looked in the mirror, and smiled her big smile and said, "I am Shelly Bean, the sports queen." She was proud of herself. Today, Shelly learned how to play catch. And they show Shelly, and she's got her crown that she made. She's got the hockey skates and stick there, and a basketball, and now the baseball mitt, and a soccer ball, all the things she learned to do this week, and swim. Looks like she drew some water on there, too. So that was when she learned how to swim earlier this week. So that is the end. Sport plays a game of catch. And again, we just want to thank Shelly Boyum Breen so much for sending me these books to share with you. What a good writer Shelly Boyum Breen is. And we're going to make sure that these books go to the library and kids can read them for themselves if they want to later on when we all get back to normal again. So thank you again. We'll have some new children's books on Monday. We'll start a different series, and another local author sent me some books, and we're going to start with those. So that's going to be fun on Monday, a whole new set of books to read about. But When we come back, we're going to go back with John Steinbeck to the Dust Bowl era in the 30s and part of his The Red Pony story. We're going to have chapter two of that one after last week's The Red Pony got us started. Today, it's all about the mountains. This is set out in California during the Dust Bowl era, so we'll take a little bit of a break and come back with that on Reading with Rick. Welcome back to Reading with Rick, and before we start on part two of John Steinbeck's The Red Pony story, we want to say hello and thanks for listening to Emma Skiba. Emma, along as Jack and Annie's magic treehouse adventure took them out to the Wild Wild West, she's even able to use that as a reading counts test on the book, so that helped her toward her reading goal for school, so that's so good, that's extra special that Emma Skiba was able to do that with us last night. So good job, Emma, and thanks for listening along with us. Okay, so let's return back to the 1930s in California, John Steinbeck's The Red Pony. Last week, we heard about Jody Tiflin. He's kind of the main character in this story. His dad is Carl Tiflin, and he's kind of a mean, stern dad. These were tough times back then. They lived on a ranch out in California. They had one ranch hand, and Billy Buck was his name. And, of course, they had the mom as well. So we are going to find out the next adventure for John Steinbeck's The Red Pony. This part of the story is titled The Great Mountains. Let's get started. In the humming heat of a midsummer afternoon, the little boy Jody listlessly looked about the ranch for something to do. He'd been to the barn. He'd thrown rocks at the swallow's nest under the eaves until every one of the little mud houses broke open and dropped its lining of straw and dirty feathers. Then, at the ranch house, he baited a rat trap with stale cheese and set it where Doubletree Mutt, that good big dog, would get his nose snapped. Jody was not moved by an impulse of cruelty. He was bored with the long, hot afternoon. Doubletree Mutt put his stupid nose in the trap and got it smacked, and shrieked with agony and limped away with blood on his nostrils. No matter where he was hurt, Mutt limped. It was just a way he had. Once when he was young, Mutt got caught in a coyote trap, and always after that he limped, even when he was scolded. When Mutt yelped, Jody's mother called from inside the house, "Jody, stop torturing that dog and find something to do." Jody felt mean then, so he threw a rock at Mutt. Then he took his slingshot from the porch and walked up toward the brush line to try to kill a bird. It was a good slingshot with store-bought rubbers, while Jody had often shot at birds, he'd never hit one. He walked up through the vegetable patch, kicking his bare toes into the dust. And on the way, he found the perfect slingshot stone, round and slightly flattened and heavy enough to carry through the air. He fitted it into the leather pouch of his weapon and proceeded to the brush line. His eyes narrowed, his mouth worked strenuously. For the first time that afternoon, he was intent. In the shade of the sagebrush, the little birds were working, scratching in the leaves, flying restlessly a few feet and scratching again. Jody pulled back the rubbers of the sling and advanced cautiously. One little thrush paused and looked at him and crouched, ready to fly. Jody sidled nearer, moving one foot slowly after the other. When he was 20 feet away, he carefully raised the sling and aimed. The stone whizzed, the thrush started up and flew right into it. And down the little bird went with a broken head. Jody ran to it and picked it up. "Well, I got you," he said. The bird looked much smaller dead than it had alive. Jody felt a little mean pain in his stomach, so he took out his pocket knife and cut off the bird's head. Then he disemboweled it, took off its wings, and finally threw all the pieces into the brush. He didn't care about the bird or its life, but he knew what older people would say if they'd seen him kill it. He was ashamed because of their potential opinion. He decided to forget the whole thing as quickly as he could and never mention it. The hills were dry at this season, and the wild grass was golden. But where the spring pipe filled with a round tub and the tub spilled over, there lay a stretch of fine green grass, deep and sweet and moist. Jody drank from the mossy tub and washed the bird's blood from his hands in cold water. Then he lay on his back in the grass and looked up at the dumpling summer clouds. By closing one eye and destroying perspective, he brought them down within his reach, so that he could put up his fingers and stroke them. He helped the gentle wind push them down the sky. It seemed to him that they went faster for his help. One fat white cloud he helped clear to the mountain rims and pressed it firmly over out of sight. Jody wondered what it was seeing then. He sat up, the better to look at the great mountains where they went piling back, growing darker and more savage until they finished with one jagged ridge high up against the west. Curious secret mountains. He thought of the little he knew about them. "What's on the other side?" he'd asked his father once. "More mountains, I guess. Why?" "And on the other side of them?" "More mountains. Why?" "More mountains, on and on?" "Well, no, at last you come to the ocean." "But what's in the mountains?" "Just cliffs and brush and rocks and dryness." "Were you ever there?" "Nope." "Has anybody ever been there?" "A few people, I guess. It's dangerous with cliffs and things. Why, I've read there's more unexplored country in the mountains of Monterey County than in any place in the United States." And his father seemed proud that this should be so. "And at last the ocean?" "At last the ocean." "But," the boy insisted, "but in between, no one knows?" "Oh, a few people do, I guess, but there's nothing there to get. And not much water, just rocks and cliffs and greasewood. Why?" "It would be good to go." "What for? There's nothing there." Jody knew something was there, something very wonderful, because it wasn't known, something secret and mysterious. He could feel within himself that this was so. He said to his mother, "Do you know what's in the big mountains?" She looked at him and then back at the ferocious range, and she said, "Only the bear, I guess." "What bear?" "Why, the one that went over the mountain to see what he could see." Jody questioned Billy Buck, the ranch hand, about the possibility of ancient cities lost in the mountains, but Billy agreed with Jody's father. "It ain't likely," Billy said. "There'd be nothing to eat unless a kind of people that can eat rocks live there." That was all the information Jody ever got, and it made the mountains dear to him and terrible. He thought often of the miles of ridge after ridge until at last there was the sea. When the peaks were pink in the morning, they invited him among them, and when the sun had gone over the edge in the evening and the mountains were a purple-like despair, then Jody was afraid of them. Then they were so impersonal and aloof that their very imperturbability was a threat. Now he turned his head toward the mountains of the east, the Gabalons, and they were jolly mountains with hill ranches in their creases and with pine trees growing on the crests. People lived there, and battles had been fought against the Mexicans on the slopes. He looked back for an instant at the Great Ones and shivered a little at the contrast. The foothill cup of the home ranch below him was sunny and safe. The house gleamed with white light, and the barn was brown and warm. The red cows on the farther hill ate their way slowly toward the north. Even the dark cypress tree by the bunkhouse was usual and safe. The chickens scratched about in the dust of the farmyard with quick, waltzing steps. Then a moving figure caught Jody's eye. A man walked slowly over the brow of the hill on the road from Salinas, and he was headed toward the house. Jody stood up and moved down toward the house, too, for if someone was coming, he wanted to be there to see. By the time the boy had got to the house, the walking man was only halfway down the road, a lean man, very straight in the shoulders. Jody could tell he was old only because his heel struck the ground with hard jerks. As he approached near, Jody saw that he was dressed in blue jeans and in a coat of the same material. He wore clodhopper shoes and an old flat-brimmed Stetson hat. Over his shoulders he carried a gunny sack, lumpy and full. In a few moments he'd trudged close enough so that his face could be seen, and his face was as dark as dried beef. A mustache, blue-white against the dark skin, hovered over his mouth, and his hair was white too, where it showed at his neck. The skin of his face had shrunk back against the skull until it defined bone, not flesh, and made the nose and chin seem sharp and fragile. The eyes were large and deep and dark, with eyelids stretched tightly over them. Irises and pupils were one and very black, but the eyeballs were brown. There were no wrinkles in the face at all. This old man wore a blue denim coat buttoned to the throat with brass buttons, as all men do who wear no shirts. Out of the sleeves came strong, bony wrists and hands gnarled and knotted and hard as peach branches. The nails were flat and blunt and shiny. The old man drew close to the gate and swung down his sack when he confronted Jody. His lips fluttered a little and a soft, impersonal voice came from between them. "Do you live here?" Jody was embarrassed. He turned and looked at the house, and he turned back and looked toward the barn where his father and Billy Buck were. "Yes," he said, when no help came from either direction. "I have come back," the old man said. "I am Gaetano, and I have come back." Jody could not take all this responsibility. He turned abruptly and ran into the house for help, and the screen door banged after it. His mother was in the kitchen, poking out the clogged holes of a colander with a hairpin and biting her lower lip with concentration. "It's an old man," Jody cried excitedly. "It's an old paisano man, and he says he's come back." His mother put down the colander and stuck the hairpin behind the sink board. "What's the matter now?" she asked patiently. "It's an old man outside. Come on out." "Well, what does he want?" She untied the strings of her apron and smoothed her hair with her fingers. "I don't know. He came walking." His mother smoothed down her dress and went out, and Jody followed her. Gaetano had not moved. "Yes?" Mrs. Tiflin asked. Gaetano took off his old black hat and held it with both hands in front of him. He repeated, "I am Gaetano, and I have come back." "Come back? Back where?" Gaetano's whole straight body leaned forward a little. His right hand described the circle of the hills, the sloping fields and the mountains, and ended at his hat again. "Back at the rancho. I was born here, and my father, too." "Here?" she demanded. "This isn't an old place." "No, there," he said, pointing to the western ridge, "on the other side there, in a house that is gone." And at last she understood. "The old adobe that's washed almost away, you mean?" "Yes, senora. When the rancho broke up, they put no more lime on the adobe, and the rains washed it down." Jody's mother was silent for a little, and curious homesick thoughts ran through her mind, but quickly she cleared them out. "And what do you want here now, Gaetano?" "I will stay here," he said quietly, "until I die." "But we don't need an extra man here." "I cannot work hard any more, senora. I can milk a cow, feed chickens, cut a little wood, no more. I will stay here." He indicated the sack on the ground beside him. "Here are my things." She turned to Jody. "Run down to the barn and call your father." And Jody dashed away, and he returned with Carl Tiflin and Billy Buck behind him. The old man was standing as he had been, but he was resting now. His whole body had sagged into a timeless repose. "What is it?" Carl Tiplin asked. "What's Jody so excited about?" Mrs. Tiplin motioned to the old man. "He wants to stay here. He wants to do a little work and stay here." "Well, we can't have him. We don't need any more men. He's too old. Billy does everything we need." They'd been talking over him as though he did not exist, and now suddenly they both hesitated and looked at Gaetano and were embarrassed. He cleared his throat. "I am too old to work. I come back where I was born." "You weren't born here," Carl said sharply. "No, in the adobe house over the hill. It was all one rancho before you came." "In the mud house that's all melted down? Yes, I and my father. I will stay here now on the rancho." "I tell you, you won't stay," Carl said angrily. "I don't need an old man. This isn't a big ranch. I can't afford food and doctor bills for an old man. You must have relatives and friends. Go to them. It's like begging to come to strangers." "I was born here," Gaetano said patiently and inflexibly. Carl Tiplin didn't like to be cruel, but he felt he must. "You can eat here tonight," he said. "You can sleep in the little room of the old bunkhouse. We'll give you your breakfast in the morning, and then you'll have to go along. Go to your friends. Don't come to die with strangers." Gaetano put on his black hat and stooped for the sack. "Here are my things," he said. Carl turned away. "Come on, Billy. We'll finish down at the barn. Jody, show him the little room in the bunkhouse." He and Billy turned back toward the barn. Mrs. Tiplin went into the house, saying over her shoulder, "I'll send some blankets down." Gaetano looked questioningly at Jody. "I'll show you where it is," Jody said. There was a cot with a shuck mattress, an apple box holding a tin lantern, and a backless rocking chair in the little room of the bunkhouse. Gaetano laid his sack carefully on the floor and sat on the bed. Jody stood shyly in the room, hesitating to go. At last he said, "Did you come out of the big mountains?" Gaetano shook his head slowly. "No, I worked down the Salinas Valley." The afternoon thought would not let Jody go. "Did you ever go into the big mountains back there?" The old dark eyes grew fixed, and their light turned inward on the years that were living in Gaetano's head. "Once, when I was a little boy, I went with my father." "Way back, clear into the mountains?" "Yes." "What was there?" Jody cried. "Did you see any people or any houses?" "No." "Well, what was there?" Gaetano's eyes remained inward. A little wrinkled strain came between his brows. "What did you see in there?" Jody repeated. "I don't know," Gaetano said. "I don't remember." "Was it terrible and dry?" "I don't remember." In his excitement, Jody had lost his shyness. "Don't you remember anything about it?" Gaetano's mouth opened for a word and remained open while his brain sought the word. "I think it was quiet. I think it was nice." Gaetano's eyes seemed to have found something back in the years, for they grew soft and a little smile seemed to come and go in them. "Didn't you ever go back in the mountains again?" Jody insisted. "No." "Didn't you ever want to?" But now Gaetano's face became impatient. "No," he said in a tone that told Jody he didn't want to talk about it anymore. The boy was held by a curious fascination. He didn't want to go away from Gaetano. His shyness returned. "Would you like to come down to the barn and see the stock?" he asked. Gaetano stood up and put on his hat and prepared to follow. It was almost evening now. They stood near the watering trough while the horses sauntered in from the hillsides for an evening drink. Gaetano rested his big twisted hands on the top rail of the fence. 5 horses came down and drank, and then stood about nibbling at the dirt or rubbing their sides against the polished wood of the fence. Long after they had finished drinking, an old horse appeared over the brow of the hill and came painfully down. It had long yellow teeth, its hooves were flat and sharp as spades, and its ribs and hip bones jutted out under its skin. It hobbled up to the trough and drank water with a loud sucking noise. "That's old Easter," Jody explained. "That's the first horse my father ever had. He's 30 years old." He looked up into Gaetano's old eyes for some response. "No good anymore," Gaetano said. Jody's father and Billy Buck came out of the barn and walked over. "Too old to work," Gaetano repeated. "Just eats and pretty soon dies." Carl Tiplin caught the last words. He hated his brutality toward old Gaetano, and so he became brutal again. "It's a shame not to shoot Easter," he said. "It'd save him a lot of pains and rheumatism." He looked secretly at Gaetano to see whether he noticed the parallel. but the big bony hands didn't move, nor did the dark eyes turn from the horse. "Old things ought to be put out of their misery," Jody's father went on. "One shot, a big noise, one big pain in the head maybe, and that's all. That's better than stiffness and sore teeth." Billy Buck broke in. "They got a right to rest after they worked all of their life. Maybe they just like to walk around." Carl had been looking steadily at the skinny horse. "You can't imagine now what Easter used to look like," he said softly. "High neck, deep chest, fine barrel. He could jump a 5-bar gate in stride. I won a flat race on him when I was 15 years old. I could have got $200 for him any time. You wouldn't think how pretty he was," he checked himself, for he hated softness. "But he got to be shot now," he said. "He's got a right to rest," Billy Buck insisted. Jody's father had a humorous thought. He turned to Gaetano. "If ham and eggs grew on a side hill, I'd turn you out to pasture too," he said. "But I can't afford to pasture you in my kitchen." He laughed to Billy Buck about it as they went on towards the house. "Be a good thing for all of us if ham and eggs grew on the side hills." Jody knew how his father was probing for a place to hurt in Gaetano. He'd been probed often. His father knew every place in the boy where a word would fester. "He's only talking," Jody said. "He didn't mean it about shooting Easter. He likes Easter. That was the first horse he ever owned." The sun sank behind the high mountains as they stood there, and the ranch was hushed. Gaetano seemed to be more at home in the evening. He made a curious sharp sound with his lips and stretched one of his hands over the fence. Old Easter moved stiffly to him, and Gaetano rubbed the lean neck under the mane. "You like him?" Jody asked softly. "Yes, but he's no damn good." The triangle sounded at the ranch house. "That's supper," Jody cried. "Come on up to supper." As they walked up toward the house, Jody noticed again that Gaetano's body was as straight as that of a young man. Only by a jerkiness in his movements and by the scuffling of his heels could it be seen that he was old. The turkeys were flying heavily into the lower branches of the cypress tree by the bunkhouse. A fat, sleek ranch cat walked across the road carrying a rat so large that its tail dragged on the ground. The quail on the side hills were still sounding the Clearwater call. Jody and Gaetano came to the back steps, and Mrs. Tiflin looked out through the screen door at them. "Come running, Jody. Come in to supper, Gaetano." Carl and Billy Buck had started to eat at the long oilcloth-covered table. Jody slipped into his chair without moving it, but Gaetano stood holding his hat until Carl looked up and said, "Sit down, sit down. You might as well get your belly full before you go on." Carl was afraid he might relent and let the old man stay, and so he continued to remind himself that this couldn't be. Gaetano laid his hat on the floor and diffidently sat down. He wouldn't reach for food. Carl had to pass it to him. "Here, fill yourself up." Gaetano ate very slowly, cutting tiny pieces of meat and arranging little pats of mashed potato on his plate. The situation would not stop worrying Carl Tiflin. "Haven't you got any relatives in this part of the country?" he asked. Gaetano answered with some pride, "My brother-in-law is in Monterey. I have cousins there, too." "Well, you can go and live with them, then." "I was born here," Gaetano said in gentle rebuke. Jody's mother came in from the kitchen carrying a large bowl of tapioca pudding. Carl chuckled to her. "Did I tell you what I said to him? I said if ham and eggs grew on the side hills, I'd put him out to pasture like old Easter." Gaetano stared unmoved at his plate. "It's too bad he can't stay," said Mrs. Tiflin. "Now don't you start anything," Carl said crossly. When they'd finished eating, Carl and Billy Buck and Jody went into the living room to sit for a while. But Gaetano, without a word of farewell or thanks, walked through the kitchen and out the back door. Jody sat and secretly watched his father. He knew how mean his father felt. "This country's full of these old paisanos," Carl said to Billy Buck. "They're damn good men," Billy defended them. "They can work older than white men. I saw one of them 105 years old, and he could still ride a horse. You don't see any white men as old as Gaetano walking 20 or 30 miles." "Oh, they're tough, all right," Carl agreed. "Say, are you standing up for him, too?" "Listen, Billy," he explained, "I'm having a hard enough time keeping this ranch out of the Bank of Italy without taking on anybody else to feed. You know that, Billy." "Sure, I know," said Billy. "If you was rich, it'd be different." "That's right. And it isn't like he didn't have relatives to go to. a brother-in-law and cousins right in Monterey. Why should I worry about him? Jody sat quietly listening, and he seemed to hear Gaetano's gentle voice, and it's unwaverable, but I was born here. Gaetano was mysterious like the mountains. There were ranges back as far as you could see, but behind the last range piled up against the sky, there was a great unknown country. And Gaetano was an old man until you got to the dull dark eyes, and behind them was some unknown thing. He didn't ever say enough to let you guess what was inside under those eyes. Jody felt himself irresistibly drawn toward the bunkhouse. He slipped from his chair while his father was talking and went out the door without making a sound. The night was very dark, and far-off noises carried in clearly. The handbells of a wood team sounded from way over the hill on the country road. Jody picked his way across the dark yard. He could see a light through the window of the little room of the bunkhouse. Because the night was secret, he walked quietly up to the window and peered in. Gaetano sat in the rocking chair, and his back was toward the window. His right arm moved slowly back and forth in front of him. Jody pushed the door open and walked in. Gaetano jerked upright, and seizing a piece of deerskin, he tried to throw it over the thing in his lap, but the skin slipped away. Jody stood overwhelmed by the thing in Gaetano's hand, a lean and lovely rapier with a golden basket hilt. The blade was like a thin ray of dark light. The hilt was pierced and intricately carved. "What is it?" Jody demanded. Gaetano only looked at him with resentful eyes, and he picked up the fallen deerskin and firmly wrapped the beautiful blade in it. Jody put out his hand. "Can I see it?" Gaetano's eyes smoldered angrily, and he shook his head. "Where'd you get it? Where'd it come from?" And now Gaetano regarded him profoundly, as though he pondered. "I got it from my father." "Well, where'd he get it?" Gaetano looked down at the long deerskin parcel in his hand. "I don't know." "Didn't he ever tell you?" "No." "What do you do with it?" Gaetano looked slightly surprised. "Nothing. I just keep it." "Can I see it again?" The old man slowly unwrapped the shining blade and let the lamp light slip along it for a moment, and then he wrapped it up again. "You go now. I want to go to bed." He blew out the lamp almost before Jody had closed the door. As he went back toward the house, Jody knew one thing more sharply than he'd ever known anything. He must never tell anyone about the rapier. It would be a dreadful thing to tell anyone about it, for it would destroy some fragile structure of truth. It was a truth that might be shattered by division. On the way across the dark yard, Jody passed Billy Buck. "They're wondering where you are," Billy said. Jody slipped into the living room, and his father turned to him. "Where have you been?" "I just went out to see if I caught any rats in my new trap." "It's time you went to bed," his father said. Jody was first at the breakfast table in the morning. Then his father came in, and last Billy Buck. Mrs. Tiflin looked in from the kitchen. "Where's the old man, Billy?" she asked. "I guess he's out walking," Billy said. I looked in his room, and he wasn't there." "Maybe he started early to Monterey," said Carl. "It's a long walk." "No," Billy explained. "His sack's still in the little room." After breakfast, Jody walked down to the bunkhouse. Flies were flashing about in the sunshine. The ranch seemed especially quiet this morning. When he was sure no one was watching him, Jody went into the little room and looked into Gaetano's sack. An extra pair of long cotton underwear was there, an extra pair of jeans, and 3 pairs of worn socks. Nothing else was in the sack. A sharp loneliness fell on Jody. He walked slowly back toward the house. His father stood on the porch, talking to Mrs. Tiflin. "I guess old Easter's dead at last," he said. "I didn't see him come down to water with the other horses." In the middle of the morning, Jess Taylor from the Ridge Ranch rode down. "You didn't sell that old gray crowbait of yours, did you, Carl?" "No, of course not. Why?" "Well," Jess said, "I was out this morning early, and I saw a funny thing. I saw an old man on an old horse, no saddle, only a piece of rope for a bridle. He wasn't on the road at all. He was cutting right up straight through the brush. I think he had a gun. At least I saw something shine in his hand." "That's old Gaetano," Carl Tiflin said. "I'll see if any of my guns are missing." And he stepped into the house for a second. "Nope, all here. Which way was he headed, Jess?" "Well, that's the funny thing. He was headed straight back into the mountains." Carl laughed. They never get too old to steal, he said. I guess he just stole old Easter. Want to go after him, Carl? Hell no. Just save me burying that horse. I wonder where he got the gun. I wonder what he wants back there. Jody walked up through the vegetable patch toward the brush line. He looked searchingly at the towering mountains, ridge after ridge after ridge, until at last there was the ocean. For a moment he thought he could see a black speck crawling up the farthest ridge. Jody thought of the rapier and of Gaetano, and he thought of the great mountains. A longing caressed him, and it was so sharp that he wanted to cry to get it out of his breast. He lay down in the green grass near the round tub of the brush line. He covered his eyes with his crossed arms and lay there a long time, and he was full of nameless sorrow. And that's the end of part two of John Steinbeck's The Red Pony. Next Friday night, we'll tackle part three, which is called The Promise. We'll find out what is next in this story for Jody Tiplin, Billy Buck, Carl Tiplin. Where did Gaetano go? And we'll see how this story continues to play out. What a great story. I like this one. This is John Steinbeck's The Red Pony. Well, that's going to do it for tonight. Thanks, everybody, for listening here. And we'll be back again on Monday. So you have yourself a great weekend. And be sure to follow all the rules and listen to Mom and Dad and, you know, keep your distance from everybody. Wash those hands and just do what we need to do to get through this time until we can all be back together again. I know it's difficult, but we'll do it together. So until Monday night, thanks for checking in on Your There Sports with Feeding with Rick. Good night, everybody.